This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. This week, we're asking why the election that Labour lost, its third in a row, was also the election that Corbyn won. This was supposed to be the election that wiped out the Labour Party.
If he's there as leader, we will lose scores of seats. We'll be wiped out.
Instead, they increased their share of the vote by nearly 10%. The Conservatives are in crisis, and Labour isn't, and the prospect of Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister is now being seriously contemplated by people who described him as unelectable just 8 weeks ago.
They just imagined everything was going to be all over by June the 8th. Well, I tell you what, they underestimated us, didn't they?
Underestimated for sure and entitled to smile. But winners, they weren't. Labour fell 64 seats short of an overall majority, and the Tories got the most votes and seats. Step inside the briefing room and find out from political experts what contributed to the surprise Labour result and whether we should view it as a success or a failure. In a few minutes, I'll be speaking to two of Britain's leading political analysts to understand how various factors played out in the campaign. But first, a little history. I want to know how this Labour campaign ranks alongside others. I've invited Stephen Fielding, Professor of Political History at Nottingham University, into the briefing room.
In terms of the outcome, it's possibly a traditional result. Labour is in opposition and the Conservatives are in government. But in terms of how the campaign went and the result of the campaign and the change in relative support between the two parties, Labour put on 10% nearly in 6 or 7 weeks. And that's not just unprecedented for Labour, that's unprecedented for, I think, any opposition party in the modern era.
So as an actual result, what would be the nearest comparable result?
Well, if we look at swing, it's actually just a little bit less good as the performance that was achieved in 1992 under Neil Kinnock, which of course also left Labour out of office, but was seen as a tremendous defeat for the party because everybody expected Labour to do much better and maybe even form a government. Whereas this time round, 2% swing, everybody thinks Labour's on the verge of getting into power and everyone's very optimistic.
OK, now let's talk about the manifesto. The Labour manifesto was perceived as being pretty left-wing. How did it compare to past Labour manifestos?
It was not the most radical manifesto Labour's put to the country. That was, without any shadow of a doubt, the 1945 manifesto, which in the end took in 20% of the British economy into national state hands. So this manifesto wasn't even close to that. It wasn't really even close compared to the February 1974 manifesto, which, building on the state of nationalisation, the extent of it established after 45, Labour was promising to randomly, I mean, it didn't even specify which industries, which companies it would take into state control. And 1983, of course, if you're interested in unilateral nuclear disarmament, 1983, Labour was committed to that. 1987, Labour was committed to that.
And also, if my memory serves me correctly, and ironically, to leaving the EEC, the forerunner of the European Union.
Well, that's one of the paradoxes of the 1983 manifesto, you know, meant to be the longest suicide note in history, and yet it includes one of the subsequently most popular policies.
Now, another orthodoxy, and you've half referred to it already, is that campaigns make very little difference to the outcome of elections. I'm afraid that I have been known to utter this what I thought was a truism myself. Actually, is that true historically? And what was different this time?
Yes, I mean, there are two basic old laws of British politics. One is governments lose elections, positions don't win them. But the second is that campaigns don't really make very much of a difference. And I don't think there has been a campaign like this one. The Conservatives went from a 20% lead to a 2% lead. That has never happened before.
It's never happened before.
Never happened before. I mean, 1945 might be referred to as an election where everybody anticipated Churchill would get in, but there is all kinds of evidence which suggests that people had basically made up their mind between 1940 and 1942.
OK, so the result itself, in terms of whether it was a shock or not, I mean, everybody sees this as a kind of law lover duck election. My God, I went in absolutely certain that X would happen, and
yes,
I came out and completely the opposite Y had happened. In historical terms, was it really an election like that, or have other elections provided bigger shocks?
There have been. Well, 1945 was most definitely a shock. Everybody anticipated Churchill would get back in. I think even leading members of the shadow cabinet had already booked their holidays in anticipation of being in opposition. 1970 was a shock when everybody expected Wilson would calmly walk back in to number 10 and Edward Heath, an incredibly unpopular leader, that he got in. That was most definitely a shock.
It's what I say to my daughters. I say to them, look, you think this was an unexpected election. I was there for 1970. And now, pushing it forward, Stephen Fielding, based on this election, what kind of swing and what kind of voters would Labour have to attract to go from this to winning a parliamentary majority?
Well, Labour needs to hold on to this unprecedented level of youth support and basically needs to get more old folk on board as well. And there's a whole range of suburban seats that Labour did not get, where all those marginals are, and they're socially mixed. So the kind of voter that Labour needs to win over is older, male, skilled or semi-skilled member of the working class.
Professor Stephen Fielding, one of the constituencies that the Conservatives hoped they would win was Warwick and Leamington in the Midlands. Our reporter, Sam Bright, has been to Warwick to hear how the campaign played out there and resulted in an extraordinary turnaround for Labour.
So I'm here in Warwick on a quite picturesque British summer's day. There are people sat outside tea shops, probably not thinking too much about the general election. However, last week, the Warwick and Leamington constituency was the scene of a quite dramatic political shock. Prior to the general election, the seat had only ever elected one Labour MP in its 132-year history. Labour's James Paskett won the seat in three consecutive elections during the Blair years. Generally speaking, though, if the Conservative Party is confident of a strong performance, or even a decent one at that, it banks on winning this seat. On the 8th of June, an 11.7% surge in Labour votes produced a shock result, stripping the seat from the Conservatives and handing it to the Labour candidate, Matt Weston. So we've come here to speak to local campaigners and to find out how exactly the Labour Party pilfered this Tory-held seat.
My name is Dave Sternberg. I'm acting secretary of the Warwick branch Labour Party.
So, Dave, we're here at the Oaken Tea Rooms, sat out on a nice summer's afternoon. But before the 8th of June, I imagine you were trying to get your message across to potential voters. Why did your campaign perform so well, do you think?
Why did our campaign go well? It's really difficult to say. A lot of people were a lot keener to talk to us and were a lot more positive about Labour's message, and that seemed to kind of increase during the campaign. We thought we'd actually record in the canvases on the doorstep when people said, no, you know, I'm Labour, my family's always Labour, but we have doubts about Jeremy Corbyn. But during the campaign, that seemed to reduce. People then did begin to talk about the issues as they affected them locally. Social care, very much education. And surprisingly for us, Brexit rarely came up. We're a Remain. We voted quite decisively for Remain as a constituency. I think in some ways people accepted that the referendum was it. When the manifesto came out, it got the agenda on social services and people were talking about how things affected them and their families.
So that's the view from inside the campaign. But what do experts who've been covering this area think to the result? We've come along to a sun-kissed Priory Park with Patrick Burns, who's the political editor of BBC Midlands. So Patrick, were you surprised that Warwick and Leamington swung?
Completely surprised. Just didn't see this coming. And of course we start looking into the question why. And I suppose the obvious thing, it is inescapable that Warwick is one of only two places in the Midlands. Midlands overall registered the most enthusiastic Leave vote of any region in the UK. But Warwick was one of only two exceptions. And I think, you know, you can't escape the fact that that does play part of it. Undoubtedly, the issue of Brexit, though influential, wasn't the only show in town. There were a wider range of issues to do with public services, health, education, school meals, we found through polling information, played very, very strongly in terms of that range of other issues that Labour succeeded in drawing the debate onto and away from Brexit.
So Labour have obviously outperformed expectations, or many people's expectations. Going forward, do you think that they can maintain these seats in the West Midlands?
I think a lot of what I detected on the ground was a sort of protest vote, really. And I do question how long, how durable a protest vote is. I don't think anybody really in politics at the moment can sleep too soundly in their beds.
The BBC's Patrick Burns ending that report from Sam Bright. And I should say we wanted to hear from the Conservative campaign in Warwick and Leamington, but nobody was available to speak to us, which in its own way is also a summary of the campaign. You heard there that Brexit may have played a part in the Midlands, but was that the case nationally? Well, you can't seriously do election talk without hearing from veteran political scientist John Curtis. We've asked him to explain the Brexit factor.
We certainly know that the way in which people voted was related to how they voted in the EU referendum, and that indeed this became increasingly the case as the election went on. But it isn't just the campaign. You can also actually look at the way voting has changed since 2015, and you can see that for the most part, the Labour Party gained votes since 2015 amongst those who voted Remain, whereas the Conservatives in particular lost ground amongst that group. And finally, we can look at the results of the elections themselves. In those constituencies in which there was a relatively large Remain vote, the Conservative vote actually fell on average. In contrast, in those constituencies with the highest Leave vote, the Conservatives advanced more strongly than Labour, and there was actually a small swing, therefore, to the Conservatives. So however you look at it, whether you're looking at the behaviour of individuals or whether you're looking at the behaviour of different kinds of constituencies, there clearly is a link, a relationship between how people vote in the EU referendum and what they did in the general election.
John Curtis. Joining me in the briefing room to assess what this all means are two leading experts in political analysis. James Tilley is Professor of Politics and Fellow of Jesus College, Oxford, and co-author of The New Politics of Class, which was published a couple of months ago. And welcome back to Rosie Campbell, Professor of Politics at Birkbeck University, whose speciality is in what voters want from their elected representatives. Let's kick off with that point about Brexit, following on from what John Curtis was saying. Labour managed to pick up Remain voters while still getting a section of the old UKIP vote and leavers. James, how did that happen?
That's a good question. I mean, if you look at particularly the collapse of UKIP, I think that's part of where most of this story is. So actually, majority of 2015 UKIP supporters did vote for the Conservatives, maybe even 60% of them. So only about 20% of 2015 UKIP supporters voted for Labour. Most of them went for the Conservatives. And of course, the Conservatives did increase their share of the vote at the election. It went up 5.5%, and that's where all those voters came from. But at the same time, you've got to flow in to the Conservatives from UKIP, but you've got to flow out from the Conservatives to Labour. And that flow out of votes is mainly people that voted Conservative in 2015, but then voted Remain in the 2016 referendum.
So Conservative Remainers actually switched to Labour, despite the fact that formerly Labour's position was Brexit.
Exactly right, yeah. And I think that's partially because actually Labour's position was a bit of a fudge in reality, whereas the Conservative position was pretty clear, a kind of quite a hard Brexit option in the lingo. The Labour position was a bit less clear. And so I think of those two options, if you voted Remain, that looked more attractive.
Now, Rosie Campbell, in a way this is counterintuitive, because what you'd expect to happen, yes, you'd kind of expect the Remain vote to go either to Labour or to the Liberal Democrats and so on, but you wouldn't expect any of the Brexit vote to go to Labour or to stick with Labour, and yet it appears that a fair bit did, despite the real push of the image of the Tories as being stronger on Brexit.
I think it's absolutely fascinating. And at the beginning of the campaign, I was one of the people who thought that the Labour Party didn't really have a strategy on Brexit and that it was being fairly hopeless in that regard. Well, my goodness, I was wrong. Because actually, having this slightly ambiguous line that James describes played incredibly well. Because we were all talking after Brexit about a nation divided, the bifurcation of the country, how cosmopolitan, urban, young people weren't going to be able to be combined with traditional core Labour voters. Somehow Corbyn managed to do it. And that's by sending a signal of reluctant acceptance of Brexit, at the same time as talking about lots of soft Brexit options.
Does that mean that people didn't really believe he was very much in favour of Brexit, and what they wanted was a Brexit as conducted by somebody who wasn't really in favour of it?
I think what it means is that I don't think the election was about Brexit, but people's attitudes towards Brexit predict a lot of other things about them. And that's actually, Corbyn played on that incredibly well. You know, the anti-austerity really worked with the traditional voters, whereas actually his slightly Remain attitude.
Oh, so you say to a Brexit voter, well, you can have your Brexit, we give you a bit of the Brexit, but we give you all these other things that
exactly.
You like. And you say to a Remain voter, well, actually, we're pretty much kind of Remaining anyway, and so far as we're going to do this, we'll do this ambiguously and nicely.
Absolutely, it worked a dream.
James, would you agree with that?
Yeah, broadly, but I think also it's in one sense, is the Brexit election, but in another sense, isn't, because I think there's a wider realignment of the party system that's not just happened now, but over the last 5 or 10 years. And that's where you've got competition much more on a kind of social liberalism, social conservatism kind of dimension. And because of that, you've got...
Can I just ask you a question about
yeah.
that specifically? Do you think, to a certain extent, that the kind of Leave-Remain thing is also a kind of stand-in for social liberalism, social conservatism?
That's exactly what I mean, in fact, yeah. So, I mean, all attitudes towards immigration, defence policy, crime and punishment, the EU, these things kind of loosely cohere together. And, of course, what really predicts your attitudes to those kind of things is your age, your level of education, to some extent your social class. And so what do we see? We see divisions by age, divisions by education, all increasing at this election. They were there before, but they've got a lot bigger.
Now, we did hear earlier in the report from Warwick and Leamington that some of this constituted a protest vote from Remainers. Now, we don't know when the next election would be, and one fears that, you know, it could be sooner rather than later. If there, in the event of another election in the relatively near future, do we think that the Remain protest would hold up in that slightly longer term, Rosie Campbell?
Well, what I do think is that Remain attitudes are part of this battery of other attitudes that that James describes, liberalism, anti-austerity. And I don't think this huge gap between older and younger people is going to go away. If anything, it's getting bigger. By the end of the election, it was actually at the age 47 was the tipping point where you became conservative rather than Labour. And so I think that kind of identity, which is partly around Remain, I think will harden and continue.
OK, so let me continue with this question to you, Rosie Campbell. Instead of a total disaster, which was anticipated by a lot of people, Labour got a moderate defeat, which people then said was a success. Was it a success?
Well, I mean, expectations were so low that you cannot say it was anything other than a success. But actually, what we must remember is in recent elections, the two main parties have been getting about 2/3 of the vote. At this election, it goes up to over 80%. So just because of that, Labour are going to do better or look as if they're doing better. It doesn't necessarily manifest in terms of that many seats. But it was, I mean, managing to secure more of those UKIP voters than anticipated. The fact that Jeremy Corbyn had basically been hiding from the mainstream media, I think, meant that he was able to have a slight Nick Clegg effect. People didn't really know who he was and they just heard bad things about him. And then suddenly they saw him.
I want to come back to the Corbyn point specifically, but stick with the point that Rosie Campbell made just there, James, about third-party politics. One of the noticeable things to those of us who have been kind of looking at the long-term decline of the two-party vote, because they used to get 90% of it, and then they'd gone down to about 65%, was it shot right up into the 80s again.
Yeah.
How did you account for that?
I mean, third-party politics is finished, I guess, would be what's happened. And I think that's the big story, just like Rosie says. It's two parties resurgent. Again, UKIP's disappeared, the Greens have halved their support, S&P support's gone down. The Liberal Democrats managed to have a declining vote share, even from that incredibly low base in 2015. So actually a lot of the increase in Labour's vote has come from cannibalising some of the smaller parties, just as the increase in the Conservative vote has come from the UKIP vote. So.
But why in an era that is said to be an era of popular protest, would you get, and an era, after all, where, say, over in France, Emmanuel Macron has just done away with both major parties at one fell swoop. Why in here in Britain do you have a situation whereby the two major parties who you expect people to protest against are strengthened?
I mean, I think the thing is it's idiosyncratic reasons for each of the minor parties rather than one big explanation.
So it's a one-off?
Well, so if you look at the Greens, for example, so their support's halved. Why is that? Well, it's basically because Labour's offering something rather similar to what they were offering previously. So why vote for the Greens when you can vote for a party that might actually have power? Look at the SNP, they're in government. So in government in Scotland, at least, being in government means you become unpopular. So therefore, people are going to vote for other parties. You look at UKIP, I mean, the reason for its existence is, you know, largely disappeared. It's lost its charismatic leader. So it's not like there's one reason. There's an explanation for each of the different parties.
Rosie Gavin's got a hand up.
I think there is one reason. It's okay. Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is not the Labour Party that we were familiar with in the New Labour period. And so he's been able to come with activists who've actually been, some of them new, but some of them from the 1980s, and come and take over the Labour Party and offer something different. So he's used the vehicle, but actually change the direction.
Are you saying that what he's done is he's replaced all the other parties of protest? I mean, the Labour was once a alternative party of government with all the kind of gravitas and, you know, frankly, evasion that goes with that, and that actually Jeremy Corbyn comes kind of sailing through and saying, no, if you want to protest, I am the biggest vehicle for protest you're ever likely to get.
Absolutely. I think the young people who were very passionately behind Jeremy Corbyn, they didn't have to deal with all this compromise of the New Labour period. Here's someone who says what they believe and has stuck with it all his life.
Well, let's talk about that then, precisely, which is leadership style. Leadership style.
Leadership style.
Now, a lot of people have said about Jeremy Corbyn and said about him, look, he's not a very great orator. He doesn't kind of, he's not a Barack Obama figure, after all. He hasn't been obviously successful in managing his parliamentary party and so on. In fact, in some ways, he's been considerably less than that. So what's he got that would appeal to an electorate?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I think he had a huge advantage and the expectations were so low that you can only kind of go upwards from there. So even imagine that the campaigns had been run equally well, the leaders had done equally well in terms of campaigning. Chances are there would have been convergence in how people saw the two leaders, because people thought Theresa May was going to be very good and they thought Jeremy Corbyn was going to be very bad. And, I mean, you know, arguably, it turned out it was the other way around, and so that led to these kind of
Isn't
this kind
he
of
like
change.
A vintage telephone. I mean, retro politician. That's very attractive to a young, trendy, funky crowd. And I'm being a little bit facetious.
Well, retro politicians, I remember, Harold Macmillan. It's not very much like
but
that.
But if you're really sick of... I mean, young people today understand how the media works. They can see through spin. If you're really sick of that and you see someone who looks and sounds like the 70s, which you think quite cool, That's part of an appeal, isn't it?
So I think the word you seem to be looking for is authenticity, which we talk about a lot in the media because we wish we had it. is that what you think that was the attraction of Jeremy Corbyn? Was the idea, well, he may not be kind of polished and he may not have all the answers and so on, but you believe that he believes what he says he believes?
He looks quite principled, basically, and I think people, that appeals to people. He's also made some good decisions in terms of the campaign, or his team did. Turning up to the debate, that was a good decision. It doesn't matter that anyone saw him.
He only
did
it the day before.
Sure, but what people remember is Theresa May didn't turn up and he did turn up, and that's seen as a good, that was a good move by Labour and a bad move by the Conservatives.
Now, we talked for a long time. I mean, it seems to me that the political agenda has been dominated, and political analysis has been dominated for the last 4 or 5 years, I beg your pardon, by the idea of populism of the right, and we described it in Europe as well. There's this kind of populist tide. Do you think that what we actually saw was a successful populism of the left?
In part, I think that's true. But, I mean, the manifesto actually was really fairly cautious, so I'm not sure we'd go as far as to call it populist. He didn't emphasise the us and them to the extent that you expect a real radical populist party to. So I think to an extent that is true by cutting through. But also a proportion of these Labour voters were public sector workers, teachers, people who just were fed up with austerity.
OK, so there's the austerity, or rather the kind of the public spending and restrictions and so on. Now, one of the things that Corbyn had to deal with was significant hostility by most of the newspapers and so on, and sections of what they call the mainstream media. Do you think, James, that one of the consequences of this election is that it told us that people aren't looking to those old forms of media for their news, and they're not actually influenced by the kind of great scare campaigns that used to go on?
I mean, it's certainly true that people are less likely to read a newspaper today in terms of physically buying a newspaper. But, of course, most of the news consumption that people have is The Sun or The Mail or The Guardian online. Just because you're reading it on computer screen doesn't necessarily make that much difference. But I think the broader question in terms of academic research on media effects is that aren't very much. That is that the media just basically reinforces people's opinions. So if you tell me you read The Guardian, then I can make a good guess on how you're going to vote. But it's not, you don't vote Labour because you read The Guardian, you buy The Guardian because you vote Labour. And that's really how the media operates. It's about reinforcing people's views, mainly. So there's a more limited role for the media than probably journalists like to think, anyway.
Roger Cameron.
Well, I think that all of that's right. Obviously, I'm not going to disagree with my colleague. But
you can.
I can, of course I would. But I think that's all right. But one thing the media can do is they kind of create the issue, make issues salient or not. So they don't tell us what to think, but they tell us what's important. And I think also media exposure is really important. So, you know, we saw that with the Nick Clegg effect that I mentioned before. If you really haven't been exposed to politicians, you don't have any views on them, you're going to have quite a soft feeling about them. Whereas suddenly they're present. Actually, Jeremy Corbyn was suddenly much more present in the campaign. It gave people the opportunity to decide that they liked him.
OK, one final question we've got time for. It's not fair, really, but I don't care. If there is another election in a few months' time, do you think the outcome would be the same? Do you think Labour might do better? What do you think?
Well, having recently seen a colleague eating pages from his book live on the television, I am going to be slightly cautious. I think, you know, if there was to be an election tomorrow, it does look as if the Labour Party would do well, given the way Corbyn's ratings have surged. But a lot could happen in the time between now and a few months' time.
James, can you do even better than that? And quickly.
I can hedge it even more than that, if you want. I mean, my record of predictions has not exactly been stellar recently. But I think I would actually have a slightly different view, which is, certainly, if the election were not tomorrow, but in a few months, my hunch is, at least, the parties might actually end up getting quite similar shares of the vote. That doesn't mean that you couldn't end up with a majority Labour government or majority Conservative government, but the actual shares of the vote are probably going to be similar. And in that sense, like, two-party politics is probably back for the near future anyway.
Rosie, do you want another go at this? Because he's kind of outlined it a little bit more. Would you accept that?
What do I think? Well, he's been very cautious. We saw how much change happened last time. We had what looked like a coronation that turned turned out to be a beheading. So I really think we have to be careful about what's going to happen next.
I'm obviously not going to be able to draw you any further than that, am I? So anyway, well, thank you very much indeed. That's all for this episode of The Briefing Room. I'd like to thank my guests, John Curtis, Stephen Fielding, Rosie Campbell and James Tilley. My producers for this episode were China Collins and Sam Bright, who you heard from earlier. The programme will be back in July. If you'd like to let us know what you think about the series, there's an easy way to do it. Just write a review or rating on iTunes or your podcast provider, and we look forward to reading your comments.